This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, November 7th, 2017. And if it's Election Day where you are, don't forget to get out and vote.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. When a mass shooting like the one in Sutherland Springs happens, we can get wrapped up in the numbers and the shooter's motives and forget that every death leaves a wake of grief.
I was at Harvest Christian. That's the church that I go to in Floresville.
Debbie Bolf was in church 13 miles away from Sutherland Springs on Sunday.
And when I got out of church, of course, I checked my cell phone, and all over social media, it was active shooter at First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs. My first thought went to Carla. She was best friend, and her family, because I know they go to church every Sunday.
Carla Holcomb was the youth director at the First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs.
I tried to call because they would have been out of church, and she didn't answer her phone, and I got a very heavy feeling in my gut.
And then Debbie got the phone call.
My daughter-in-law called me, and she said that someone had called her that they had confirmed that Brian and Carla, they had been identified, were dead. And, of course, you know, that just hit me like a load of bricks because I've known them for so long. And I love them to death. And I can't believe something like this would happen.
Brian and Carla weren't the only members of that family killed at services on Sunday.
Their whole family went to that church, and that's the tragedy. Brian and Carla were killed, and they had four children, John, Danny, Sarah, and Scott, and those four children had families. So John is the oldest, got shot in the leg, and his pregnant wife, Crystal, was killed. He had two daughters and a son that were killed. He is devastated, and though he's going to be okay physically, everybody's fearful for his emotional health right now. Little Evelyn had a bump on her head, and she survived, but they said that somebody fell on her. And that's what saved her life. Danny, John's brother, was killed, and his 18-month-old daughter. His wife is okay. Sarah, of course, her husband Rocky and their daughter were fine. And then I believe Scott didn't go to church that morning, and his whole family's fine. So that was 9 people. Out of that family.
9 people. Debbie is counting Crystal's unborn child. Crystal was 8 months pregnant. And through the horrific tragedy, Debbie wants people to know what her friend was like in life.
I've known Carla for 30 years, and we've done a lot of stuff together as far as raising money, community service kind of stuff. Carla and I just had a blast because we were of like mind, and we were very creative, and we loved doing that kind of stuff, putting on events and raising money. And Carla would take the shirt off of her back, of course, to help anybody. And she loved kids. She loved working with kids. She wanted to make sure that they knew that they were loved and that they were important and that they had purpose in life. And this, I believe, was her purpose. I think this is why God had her here, because she had a purpose to make difference in kids' lives, and she did. And Brian, he was a jokester. He always would tease you, and quick-witted. He'd come up with stuff that you just have to laugh at. Both of them were very social, very loving, the best neighbors you could have. The best friends you could have.
Now, Debbie says, she just feels numb.
I want to cry every time I think of her because she was such a good person. it's a great loss for her and Brian to leave us because they did so much good in our community. It will be a big void. As humans, when we have to deal with death, the people that leave us have the better end. As Christians, we know that our loved ones go to heaven, and that gives us solace. But we're the ones that are having to stay behind and wrap our heads around this and figure out how we're going to go through life without our loved ones. One of the aunts from the children that died called me, and she told me, she says, when do we stop crying? And I told her, I said, when we're totally exhausted is when we stop crying and our emotions are totally void and depleted because we're so exhausted. And then she asked me, she says, when does the pain go away? And I told her, I said, the pain never really goes away. It's like a deep wound, and it takes a long time to heal, but you never forget.
Debbie says blame isn't the answer. It's about picking up the pieces, picking up your lives, and moving forward.
Do I blame the shooter? No. I think he was a vessel. I feel bad for his parents, his family. I don't think he was in his right mind. I don't think he really understood the scope of what he was doing. Because he walked up to that church and they said he had already started shooting and before he even got in there. What does that tell me? That tells me that he was scared. He was doing something that he thought he needed to do to right a wrong. And he was mistaken. He was mistaken.
Debbie Bolf is a neighbor and a friend near Sutherland Springs, Texas. She's the executive director of the All City Youth Programs, an organization for at-risk youth in nearby Floresville. She spoke to Takeaway senior producer Ellen Frankman.
This is ridiculous what happened. It's unfathomable that this happened to us, but it's not going to destroy us. It makes us stronger.
Sales of AR-15s have exploded.
The AR-15.
The AR-15 assault rifle used in the Orlando terrorist attack.
The AR-15 can be used for hunting.
One of the most popular and most reviled weapons in America.
The National Rifle Association calls the AR-15 America's gun. The assailant in Sutherland Springs, Texas, used a variant of the AR-15 to murder 26 people on Sunday. And according to the NRA, it's the most popular rifle in the United States. The AR-15 is a military weapon. The U.S. military version is called the M-16, and it's been on the scene since the Vietnam War. The civilian version available today is semi-automatic, very easy to get and easy to modify. In the case of the Sutherland Springs shooter, Devin Kelly, the Air Force failed to alert federal law enforcement about his history of domestic violence, as it was supposed to. Kelly easily obtained the dangerous weapons he used in the massacre, including the AR-15-style rifle. Well, as much as American gun owners appear to love the AR-15, perpetrators of some of the country's worst mass shootings choose it too. Sandy Hook, San Bernardino, Orlando, Las Vegas, and now Sutherland Springs, all with variants of the AR-15. AJ Somerset is a writer and author of the book Arms, The Culture and Credo of the Gun, and he's here to explain the history of the AR-15 and why it's so popular. AJ, welcome.
Hello.
Well, that's the question. What do people love so much about the AR-15 and why is it so wildly popular?
Well, I think the most important reason is that the AR-15 is just cool. It's a good gun. That is, you know, it's accurate and it's reliable, but it's also a modular kind of design, which lets people who, you know, don't have skill as gunsmiths, it lets them change out components and parts and customize their rifle to suit their needs or desires.
Talk about the experience of shooting the AR-15 and why people who aren't necessarily, you know, gun experts or marksmen still like it.
as a rifle, it's a fairly accurate rifle, and it's an easy to use rifle. The standard AR-15 caliber is a 223, which is a fairly light recoiling round, so it doesn't punish you. So it's comfortable to shoot, and you can shoot it rapid fire fairly accurately with it.
So AJ, you described one of the appeals of the AR-15 that is just a cool gun. And I get that for people who are gun enthusiasts. They want to own it. It's fun to shoot and fun to modify. Does that idea of it being a cool gun, does that ever diminish for people when they see this favorite rifle being used in mass shooting after mass shooting in America? We went down the list. And I wonder how that affects people's perception of the coolness.
Well, I don't think it does. And there's a couple of things going on there. One is that within any mass shooting, as the story comes out, it's possible to fit the facts to more than one point of view. So the gun culture view of this most recent shooting in Texas is that it was stopped by a good guy with a gun. Never mind that 46 people were shot before it was stopped, but it was stopped, which is exactly the story they want to tell. So that's the point of view they take on it. And it does not, nothing ever shocks people into saying, gosh, maybe we're going down the wrong path here. The other thing that's there is that mass shootings provoke fear. And part of the popularity of the AR-15 and similar rifles since the expiry of the assault weapons ban has been fear-driven. The if you are a subscriber to the ideas of the gun culture, then that fear manifests itself not in calls for regulation, but in a desire to arm yourself and buy ammunition. So mass shootings actually lead people to want to buy the gun.
Well, AJ, we talked to our listeners about this. We put out the call and asked them if they own the AR-15, and if so, what they like about it.
My name is Aaron Brett, and I'm from Atkins, Arkansas. Yes, I own an AR-15 and several other rifles that would be considered assault rifles by the left-wing media. I use them to hunt and for recreation with my friends. We go target shooting and other, you know, activities.
This is Catherine in Dallas, Texas. I do not own one, but I do own a shotgun for home protection, and I also have a semi-automatic handgun, which I carry with me.
This is Andrew from Boca. I use an M16 in the Army Reserve, and that's almost an identical weapon to the AR-15. It's a really, really powerful weapon. It's really also easy to use. I think that it should never be in the hands of civilians.
This is Robert. I'm calling from Alaska, and I own an AR-15. I got out of the Army shortly after a 15-month deployment. I felt completely naked without it.
You, Takeaway listeners and gun owners, called in and told us what you like about the AR-15 rifle. And so we continue now my conversation about the wildly popular AR-15 with AJ Somerset, author of Arms, The Culture and Credo of the Gun. AJ, what about the firepower of this weapon? One of the debates around the AR-15 is not the gun itself, but how many bullets it can hold, how many bullets it can fire, and how lethal it is if an assailant wants to use it.
Well, the AR-15 has got an interesting controversy surrounding its firepower. There's this myth that seems to have grown up around it, that it has exceptional power, that it's an exceptionally powerful gun. And in fact, the cartridge it fires at 223 or 5.56 NATO is not a particularly powerful cartridge. It's a very small bullet traveling very fast, and it tends to cause pretty terrible wounds rather than killing people outright. The AR-15 cartridge is something that deer hunters wouldn't use on deer because it doesn't produce a quick, clean kill. And so this leads people to say, oh no, the AR-15 is not that powerful, when they're pushing back against gun control arguments. In fact, the deer would wander off and die. So the point is kind of moot, but it doesn't have that mythic power that people attribute to it. The bigger concern with rifles like the AR-15 is simply that they take that interchangeable box magazine. So I can have, you know, a standard magazine for it would be 30 rounds. I have 30 rounds in the gun. I've got another 60 rounds on my person. I can change magazines very quickly. I can fire a lot of bullets. We get inured to the numbers until something really exceptional like Las Vegas happens. The shooting in Texas doesn't seem that remarkable until you stop and consider those numbers again. A man walked into a church and he shot 46 people. That's a remarkable number. He shot 46 people and then walked out. And this is what having that interchangeable box magazine enables you to do. You can't walk into a church with a bolt-action rifle and shoot 46 people.
And does that help explain why, in addition to the AR-15 being so popular with lawful gun owners, that it's also popular with murderers?
Absolutely. If you want to pull off a mass shooting, or even if you're just fascinated with the idea that you need to defend yourself, a rifle with an interchangeable box magazine is absolutely mandatory.
So where did the AR-15 come from, AJ? How did it come on the scene? What's the history?
Well, it comes out of the experience of Vietnam. The United States Army went into Vietnam after the Second World War. The U.S. Army retained a full-size rifle cartridge, where the rest of the world wanted to go to what's called an intermediate cartridge, which is a smaller rifle cartridge. It doesn't have necessarily the same range or the same recoil. But in Vietnam, the U.S. Army sort of discovered that the rest of the world had gone that way for a reason. And the AR-15 was, you know, originally developed as a sort of a concept for the Army, and then they eventually adopted it as the M16.
So like so many popular weapons, AJ, the AR-15 has this military history, but then becomes mass marketed to civilians in America and becomes wildly popular. When did this gun cross over from a gun that was just available to one that people really clamored for?
Well, it was available through, you know, the 80s and the 90s. It was marketed to civilians, but didn't really take off. Then you had the Clinton era assault weapons ban beginning in 1994, which then expired in 2004. And with the expiry of the assault weapons ban, two things happened. One is that the firearms industry took advantage of that ban expiring and marketed these kinds of guns like crazy, with the apparent intent of if they could flood the market with these guns, they become that much harder to ban again. The other thing that happened is that 2004, when that ban expires, you're following on from 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq and the invasion of Afghanistan, and there's a tremendous amount of support for the military and a desire to support the troops. And owning the same firearm that the U.S. armed forces use becomes almost an expression of patriotism. And for people who did serve, it's attractive to come home, leave the service, and then simply buy the gun that you used to use when you were in the Army.
So there's this crossover point, AJ, from a gun being popular with gun enthusiasts to it reaching kind of celebrated fan status. We've talked about the Glock on the show before, where experts said there was a similar experience. The Glock became much more than just a handgun. It became a symbol and a must-have for handguns. And I think you're saying that the AR-15 is sort of like that for rifles.
Yeah, I think it is. Because it is associated with the United States, it's an American design. It's the same rifle the military uses. And like the Glock was kind of a revolutionary pistol. The AR-15, as a sort of modular design, is sort of the last revolution or the most recent revolution in the design of firearms.
So, AJ, are you an AR-15 owner?
No, I'm not. When I was in the military, you know, I used the Canadian Army's version of that rifle, but I felt that I had, you know, I've done that, so I don't really have a desire to own one.
If you wanted to own one, could you in Canada?
I could, but here in Canada, it's a restricted firearm, so it's more difficult to buy than just a regular rifle.
Well, AJ, we've heard from lots of listeners here on The Takeaway. We put the call out and asked people if they own an AR-15 and if they love it. And we got a lot of responses from gun owners who love that gun. And I'm going to guess that that's not a surprise to you.
No, it wouldn't be. I mean, as I said previously, when I was in the Canadian military, I used our version of the M16, which is the C7. And it's essentially the same gun. And it's a great gun. If I owned one, I would love it.
AJ Somerset is author of Arms, The Culture and Credo of the Gun. AJ, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us here on The Takeaway today. I'm Todd Zwillick. A year and a half after the Panama Papers revealed a network of tax havens used by celebrities and politicians worldwide, the International Consortium of Journalists released the Paradise Papers over the weekend, 13.4 million documents, mostly from one of the world's biggest offshore law firms called Appleby. Now, these documents reveal the offshore interests and activities of over 120 politicians, including the Queen of England, and also detail the financial engineering of 13 advisors and donors, even in cabinet members of President Donald Trump. They include Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, whose financial ties could have implications in the Russia investigation. Ross holds a stake in a shipping company called Navigator, and Navigator's top clients include a Russian firm called Sibor, controlled by the son-in-law of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Now, Ross has denied any wrongdoing in an interview with the BBC on Monday.
I think the media has made a lot more out of it than it deserves. There's nothing whatsoever improper about Navigator having a relationship with Sibor. The fact that it happens to be called a Russian company does not mean that there's any evil in it.
Doesn't mean there's any evil in it, but Ross later said that he'll likely sell his shares in Navigator now. Gerard Ryle is here. Gerard led the international team that broke the Paradise Papers as the director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Gerard, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
13.4 million documents, companies that specialize in setting up offshore companies and hiding the money of wealthy and elite people all over the world. What do these documents really show?
Well, what we're seeing here are basically the richest companies in the world and the richest people in the world and what they're doing to avoid tax in most cases. Now, is it illegal? In most cases, it isn't. But again, that doesn't necessarily mean that the public shouldn't know about it. The documents come from a very high-end law firm, most of them from Appleby, which is largely based in Bermuda. And this is a company that specializes in setting up accounts in offshore tax havens for people who come shopping for a better deal.
So lots of people and companies are included in these revelations. Apple is on the list, so is Nike. Also people like Russian oligarchs, banks. Bono of U2 enjoys some tax havens. And also, as we mentioned, the Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross. What do the Paradise Papers reveal about his holdings?
Well, what we're seeing in the holdings, and we really did do a double take when we first saw it, is that he when he became Commerce Secretary, he divested himself of most of his interests, but he kept several companies, one of which was Navigator, which is a shipping company that does business with another company called Sibor, which is a Russian company that ships gas and oil. But the owners of Sibor include Vladimir Putin's son-in-law and also two Russian oligarchs that have been sanctioned by the U.S., Now, he says, again, there's nothing improper or evil in this. And I would, you know, also agree that it's legal. But I would have thought that this is a kind of information that people should have known about before he was appointed.
Is this the kind of financial relationship that falls under conflict of interest or potential conflict of interest or appearance of conflict of interest with an American adversary?
Well, again, I guess in the current climate, and it only becomes important. I mean, if he was in business with the son-in-law of the president of Iceland, for instance, there probably wouldn't be a big issue here. It's just in the current climate where anything to do with Russia seems to be big news. And, you know, again, I repeat, he's in business with the son-in-law of Vladimir Putin.
So there were also major revelations here about a wealthy Russian investor named Yuri Milner, who holds major stakes in Facebook and Twitter, other companies too. What did you learn about him?
Well, again, what we've learned from these documents, and again, these are documents from a law firm that helps set up these deals, is that the Russian state was an early investor in both Facebook and Twitter. Now, some of this information has come out in the past, but the fact that the money was coming directly from a bank that has been associated with Vladimir Putin is new and interesting.
So with all of these new and interesting revelations, there have been suggestions that there are ties back as well to the son-in-law of the president, senior White House advisor, Jared Kushner. What did you find out?
Well, again, Yuri Milner, who is the Russian businessman who basically was the conduit for some of this investment, also invested in Jared Kushner's company, and there's the connection. And again, all of this, it comes in a climate, I guess, of distrust, allegations that Russia, you know, interfered with the last election. I guess it's more the climate that makes this interesting than anything else.
Right, the climate, because again, legal and yet ethical considerations don't always turn on whether something is technically legal or not, especially as Americans' political concerns change. You know, it might not be knowable at this stage how much the world is missing out on taxes because of all these shelters and shell companies. But can we now narrow it down to the United States? Congress is getting ready to try to pass massive tax cuts, more than $1 trillion. How many billions of dollars are American taxpayers losing out on here because of all these shelters and shell games?
Well, what we're seeing from the documents is that the big multinational companies, the big American companies like Apple and others, are not paying the kind of taxes that that the public has been told they're paying. I mean, yes, they're paying, you know, billions of dollars, but effectively what they're doing is using financial maneuvers to make sure that a lot of the money that's earned overseas stays overseas and doesn't come back to the U.S. We were able to look very closely at Apple as one example, where basically they moved billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars that they had in Ireland to another shelter in Jersey, the island of Jersey.
Off of the UK.
Yes, and we're also, I mean, we're looking also at, you know, Uber and other companies. They're all in there, basically the maker of silicon implants. And it's, you know, I guess one of the biggest takeaways for me, certainly from these, is that the widespread use, basically everyone from the biggest companies to the smallest companies are now going offshore and, you know, using these financial maneuvers to minimize their taxes.
Gerard Ryle, International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, with some incredible reporting on 13.4 million documents revealing offshore tax havens and shelters used by some of the world's largest companies and wealthy people. Gerard, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel. BABBEL.com. And Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More at Staples stores or staples.com/print and marketing. Staples, it's pro time.
Well, possible criminal charges involving one senator in Kentucky and charges involving another in New Jersey. Closing arguments concluded on Monday, and the jury has the case in the corruption trial of New Jersey Democratic Senator Bob Menendez. Menendez and Solomon Melgen, who is a wealthy eye doctor and a donor and a friend of Menendez, they're both facing charges ranging from bribery to conspiracy to fraud. Matthew Friedman is a reporter for Politico in New Jersey, here to bring us up to date. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Todd.
Well, jury deliberations have begun. Remind us what the jury's been told about Senator Bob Menendez here.
Prosecutors would have the jury believe, their words are, that Senator Menendez was Solomon Melgen's personal senator. That Menendez, who actually in a legislative body full of very rich people, is perhaps the poorest member of the Senate, if not one of them. Most of his income is his Senate salary. And what prosecutors argue is that Menendez traded his power for the lifestyle he couldn't afford. And so Solomon Melgen flew him on private jets, put him up at $1,000 hotel rooms, and hosted him as Dominican Republic visa. And Menendez, in exchange, went to bat for Melgen with a nearly $9 million Medicare billing dispute he was having with everyone, all the way up to HHS Secretary Sebelius at the time, that he secured visas for the married Melgen's much younger foreign girlfriends, and that he actually pressured State Department officials and Commerce Department officials to in turn put pressure on Dominican officials to honor a port security contract that Melgen owned but was not being enforced that could have made him millions and millions of dollars.
And the defense attorneys for Senator Menendez, what do they say?
They point out, and it is accurate, that Menendez and Melgen have been friends for 20 years. They say that while the senator did try to help Solomon Melgen on these matters, that's not in dispute. His actions were born out of friendship, and there was never a bribe paid. Prosecutors point to campaign contributions. They point to these private jet flights. But often, in all this, in all these 6 or 7 years, this conspiracy range, prosecutors could never point to any specific instance in which Solomon Melgen said, if you do this, I'll give you this. Or if Menendez said to Melgen, if you give me this, I'll do this. That's what's missing from the case, and that's what makes it less than a slam dunk for the prosecution. Menendez says that when Melgen brought these things to his attention, yes, in a sense he was advocating for Melgen, but also Melgen's issues raised legitimate policy concerns, whether it was on the way Medicare was billing for a certain medicine or on port security in the Dominican Republic.
And if there's no obvious quid pro quo that prosecutors can point to here, Matthew Friedman, then that could be a big factor in this case. There's a Supreme Court ruling from last year. Virginia's former Republican Governor Bob McDonald was convicted of corruption and quid pro quo, not necessarily unlike this alleged case. But the Supreme Court overturned it and made it harder in cases like this to connect the quid with the quo. Could that help Menendez here?
It could. And in fact, it nearly derailed this case in a pretty odd weekend. A few weeks ago, Menendez's lawyers had made one of several motions they've made to dismiss the case. Nobody in the courtroom really expected it to go anywhere. But all of a sudden, Walsh seemed to start agreeing with the defense that there was a flaw now in this quote unquote stream of benefits theory that the prosecution's case relies on in the absence of a specific quid for a quo. Judge William Walls, who's presiding over the case, for a time seemed to agree with that from the bench. He was basically saying, I think the defense has a point here. He said, I'm going to take the weekend, I'll come back Monday and I'll rule. He came back Monday, decided everything he said didn't apply, and ultimately ruled that the stream of benefits theory survives. But it did limit the instructions that could be given to the jury. Menendez's attorneys argued what he did was not official acts because he never had actually authority. He was advocating with people in the executive department, but he never had the authority to actually make them do anything. He was just advocating. Judge Walls didn't really buy that argument, but still, in instructing the jury, he was very, very careful and used language straight out of the McDonald Supreme Court decision to make sure that ultimately, at least to the best of his ability, this would not be overturned on appeal should it come to that.
Matthew Friedman with Politico. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And a perplexing story out of Kentucky now. On Friday, Republican Senator Rand Paul was assaulted outside his home in Bowling Green. Paul's staff initially downplayed his injuries. They told reporters, Rand is fine. They've since said he sustained 5 broken ribs as well as lung contusions from the attack. Meanwhile, police have charged the senator's next-door neighbor and fellow doctor, Rene Boucher, with fourth-degree assault. Boucher was released on Saturday on a $7,500 bond. So what exactly took place on Friday between these two men, these two neighbors? For more, we turn to Adam Beam, Kentucky State House reporter for the Associated Press. Adam, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Adam, this is a strange incident, one that happened between two neighbors who've known each other for years. At first glance, this seems like it had to have been personal.
Yeah, that's right. Senator Paul appeared to be mowing his lawn on Friday afternoon in Bowling Green when he was tackled from behind. That's according to an arrest warrant by his neighbor. This is a man named Rene Boucher. He's been neighbors with Senator Paul for 17 years. Both men are doctors. Both men have worked together. I believe Dr. Boucher is an anesthesiologist. Dr. Paul is, of course, an ophthalmologist. So they've worked together through the years. And for some reason, you know, he tackled him from behind and ended up breaking 5 of his ribs.
And the nature of those injuries, I am not a medical examiner or a sports medicine expert. It seemed like 5 ribs broken from a tackle or from being kicked in the ribs or punched.
Well, we haven't heard anything beyond just that it was a tackled from behind and he was taken to the ground. Now, at first, the injuries we're told were minor. And of course, you look at the charge, he's charged with a misdemeanor assault resulting in minor injury. And so at first we thought, oh, okay, maybe he's got a few cuts, a few bruises. And then on Sunday evening, we learned that no, he's got 5 broken ribs with 3 displaced fractures. And the displaced fractures are pretty serious. I mean, if not treated and taken care of yourself, it can lead to even some life-threatening injuries. And that's according to Paul's staff.
And initially, Rand Paul's staff told reporters Rand is fine, as I mentioned. Turns out he wasn't quite fine. And Adam, as you mentioned, everybody's kind of tamping down the nature of this dispute. Rene Boucher's lawyer says it arose from trivial matters. We've been told since that it was sort of a garden dispute or a dispute about leaves and land between the two men. Seems like quite a confrontation for a dispute about a strip of land between your property.
That's right. You know, the first reports indicated that maybe this had to be some kind of political dispute because there were some neighbors who were noting that Dr. Boucher seemed to be liberal, according to some of his past Facebook posts. And then we heard from the Kentucky State Police that the FBI was actually involved. They're investigating to see if this was some type of politically motivated attack. And then Dr. Boucher's attorney, you know, tried to tamp all that down by saying, no, this was some trivial dispute. I think the only people that know for sure, 100%, what happened or why this happened is Dr. Boucher and, of course, Senator Paul. But neither one of them are talking right now.
And the charges against Rene Boucher, you mentioned misdemeanor assault. Is that bound to get worse?
It could. It very well could. I mean, if Senator Paul's injuries escalate, if we learn in the coming days that his injuries are even worse than we thought, it could. The Commonwealth's attorney has said that more charges could be filed. And of course, you know, attacking a senator, I think, could be, you know, maybe he could face some federal charges from that if the FBI concludes its investigation and finds that a federal law was broken. So ultimately, it's up to the authorities what charges will be pressed. And, you know, it appears from all the public statements from Senator Paul's staff that they're taking this very seriously. Doug Stafford, who is Senator Paul's senior advisor, said yesterday that this is a very serious pending criminal matter. You know, I don't imagine that they're going to be asking for leniency, but I don't know.
Adam Beam with the Associated Press in Kentucky. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. Thanks for being with us. I'm Todd Zwillick. The United Nations Climate Change Conference is happening this week in Bonn, Germany. And for the first time, the Assembly of First Nations is joining as an official delegate. Indigenous groups from around the world will join to discuss how their traditional knowledge and experience with environmental destruction can be a big asset as the rest of the world tries to figure out what to do about climate change. It's a topic my next two guests have worked on for decades. Victoria Tally Corpuz is an indigenous leader from the Cordillera region of the Philippines and a UN special rapporteur on the rights of indigenous peoples. And Gleb Radowski is with the Polis Project on Ecological Governance at the University of Victoria. He's the author of the new book out today called Archipelago of Hope. It documents indigenous communities' lifestyles in the face of climate change and shows, he says, why everyone should pay attention.
Well, first of all, indigenous people have a track record of maintaining their relationship with the land in a way that doesn't kill it, something that we don't really have on our resume. And so for me personally, I'd rather learn from those who actually have such resume that, you know, extends back for millennia and is based on a holistic understanding of people's place in nature.
Victoria, this resume of living with a radically changing environment that Gleb is talking about, how do you convince skeptics that this resume is a resource for indigenous communities and non-indigenous communities that are soon to be coping with climate change?
Well, first of all, I think that there's a lot of evidence that will show now that the last remaining more intact rainforests in the world today are coinciding with the traditional territories of indigenous people. So I think there are maps that have been developed that will show these overlaps. And I think that's one way to convince skeptics to show this map and to show that these areas where the ecosystem is in a better shape are areas where indigenous peoples live as well. And in areas where their rights to these territories are respected, the level of protection of these forests and nature reserves are higher compared to the ones which have been managed even by the states and, of course, by others. And the second thing is, of course, to also show that the indigenous peoples who live in these ecosystems which are in better shape are living more simply, and they are living in relationship with the nature around them.
And their traditional territories represent more than 20% of the global land area and contain close to 80% of the world's biological diversity. But yet their rights are recognized only on one-fifth of those territories. So if we really want to take heed to the messages that indigenous peoples are generously sharing with us, we should do everything possible for our own sake to recognize their rights.
Gleb, you didn't write your book to document environmental degradation, but you visited so many different communities around the world who have experience with environmental degradation that might be a lesson to the rest of the world as it confronts the realities of climate change. Tell me about people in the Russian Arctic and the annual reindeer summer migration there.
It's one of the longest, or probably the longest, annual migration still in existence in the world. It's about 800 miles. And over the last 20 or 30 years, that migration has been gradually disrupted by gas and oil development that's been taking place on the peninsula. It's an important source of natural gas for Russian state, for Russian state company Gazprom. And so the story was how this development has been impacting the annual cycle, but also how new challenges of climate change, melting permafrost, are impacting their way of life, and how, despite all of that, they still remain certain that if they are allowed to continue with their traditional migration, relying on their reindeer, they have a good future ahead of them.
Victoria, you've been hard at work your entire career getting those voices heard at the UN and other places. You helped draft the Declaration on Human Rights of Indigenous Peoples in 1993. It wasn't even adapted in the UN until 2007. What's been your own experience in the difficulty, the challenge, I'll say, in getting Indigenous peoples' voices heard when it comes to questions of the environment?
Well, I think that generally Indigenous peoples have always been in situations where they are silenced or their issues are not paid attention to by governments at the national level as well as at the global level. And I think the main reason is because the message that they want to tell the world is something that will show how dominant the modern thinking is to the point that they would like to denigrate the contributions of Indigenous peoples in sustaining the world's remaining ecosystem. And of course, the dominant voices are more partial to so-called modernization and progress, which is something that Indigenous peoples are subjected to, and it's the reason why they are also being repressed and marginalized.
Well, Victoria, here's an extremely practical idea. If these are people who come from communities with a long experience of living in concert with the land and taking a holistic approach to environmental management, it seems like they would be pretty good job candidates to help local governments run their own environmental policies.
Yes, that would really be very reasonable. But in actual reality, that's not the case. You know, in fact, in some areas, Indigenous peoples are even kept away. They are displaced from the national parks that have been designated as such. And in some instances, there are good examples, like for instance, in Australia, there are Indigenous peoples who are doing co-management. But that's not a common thing to see. But I would say that if governments realize that this is really one of the better ways to keep the environment in a better shape, then, of course, it makes a lot of sense for them to involve them and to hire them and even to compensate them for doing the things that they do anyway.
So, Gleb, each of these stories is different. They're unique, in some ways not related, but it seems to me that each of these communities is a place that has dealt with and adapted to radical changes in the environment. The rest of the world, perhaps for the first time, is confronting radical change in its own environment because of climate change. But it seems to me there's some collective experience here that people outside of Indigenous communities can learn from.
The main message is that everything is connected, and you are, as a community, as a human being, are part of this web of life, and you have to act accordingly. You don't treat it as your source of revenue, but you treat it as a neighbor, as a relative, as a living, breathing, spiritual entity that you have to maintain a respectful relationship with.
Victoria Talley-Korpuz, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And Gleb Rigorodetsky, thanks to you as well.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And before we leave you today, we go back to an act that made it possible for you and I to connect today. 50 years ago today, President Lyndon Johnson signed into law the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967.
It announces to the world that our nation wants more than just material wealth. Our nation wants more than a chicken in every pot. We in America have an appetite for excellence, too. And while we work every day to produce new goods and to create new wealth, we want most of all to enrich man's spirit. And that is the purpose of this act.
Well, speaking of new wealth, Johnson made millions from the radio stations that he and his wife Lady Bird owned in Texas. But the act that he signed allowed for the creation of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which eventually gave rise to PBS and NPR. 50 years later, we couldn't do any of this without you. So thanks for your ongoing support of public television and public radio. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.